talking history. This is News Talk.
We shall fight on the beaches, we shall fight in the hills, we shall never surrender.
And out of that silence came thousands of voices.
The strategy of the white man has always been divide and conquer.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Auchteroin, Argus, Akoiza.
Good evening and welcome. We're talking history on News Talk 106 to 108 with me, Patrick Gagan. In tonight's show, we're looking at Gladstone and Ireland, and we'll be finding out how the grand old man became a convert to Home Rule and how he has been remembered in Irish history. You can email us your thoughts and views to talkinghistory@newstalk.com, and we'd love to hear from you. Last week, we explored the abdication crisis of 1936 and found out why King Edward VIII gave up the throne and the impact it had on British politics and the British monarchy. And if you want to listen back to this or to any of our older shows, just go to the News Talk app powered by Go Loud, our website newstalk.com, or wherever you download your podcasts. Prime Minister of the United Kingdom for four non-consecutive terms, the most in history, William Ewart Gladstone dominated British politics in the second half of the 19th century. In tonight's show, we want to explore his attempts to pacify Ireland and bring in Home Rule, and also his legacy in Ireland and the UK today. And to begin tonight's discussion, I'm delighted to be joined by Professor Matthew Kelly, Professor of Modern History in the Department of Humanities at Northumbria University, Newcastle, an expert on modern British history. He has worked on the development of environmental policy in the post-war period, and his most recent book is The Women Who Saved the English Countryside. Matt, you're very welcome.
Hello, Patrick. Lovely to be with you. I should say, in the earlier part of my career, I wrote a lot about Irish nationalism and especially Fenianism, but you're quite right that I've made an environmental turn like lots of other people in more recent years.
Well, let's bring in that Irish expertise now, because let's talk about Gladstone. And he's a dominant figure in British politics. He becomes this dominant figure in Irish politics. But I suppose part of the challenge when talking about Gladstone is that the career was so long. It's six decades of a political career. And he begins as a Tory and only later becomes a Liberal. He begins anti-Catholic and later becomes this supporter of reform in Ireland. So it's a career where there are quite a few changes and evolutions.
I mean that's right. I mean, it really is hard not to talk about Gladstone in terms of kind of, I suppose, you know, superlatives and some sort of recognition of this remarkable, you know, political personality. As you say, yeah, he begins his career, you know, as a young Tory. He's famously described as the rising hope of those stern and unbending Tories. And this is in the early 1830s. And then, you know, he has various sort of ministerial roles in the 30s and 40s, and then serves as Chancellor at various points in the 1850s, 1860s and 1870s. And then, you know, as you said, he has this remarkable record as Prime Minister between 1868 to 74, 1880 to 85, and then there's the famous short ministry of 1886 when he places the first Home Rule Bill before Parliament, and then his last ministry when he really is, you know, the grand old man of 1892 to 1994 when he has his second crack, you know, at getting a Home Rule Bill through Parliament. And you know, as many listeners will know, I imagine, the first bill doesn't get through the Commons. The second bill does, but it's vetoed in the House of Lords. So in some respects, he comes also quite close to achieving that aim of delivering Home Rule for Ireland. You know, I suppose we might say he didn't quite have his ducks lined up in the 1890s. But yeah, it's an absolutely sort of remarkable journey, if you like, from that, you know, stern and unbending Tory, you know, the young Gladstone, something, for example, of an apologist for slavery, not what we would associate, you know, with a liberal reforming and, you know, highly moralizing politician. But he goes through, I suppose, a sort of a gradual kind of conversion from the sort of 1830s onwards. A lot of historians would say that a really crucial moment in that development that in a sense makes Gladstone a liberal and in some ways a pluralist, and that might be something we want to talk about a little bit, is his decision to support Peel's Maynooth grant in 1845, and that grant would have, when that grant saw the state commit itself to funding more or less in perpetuity an Irish Catholic seminary, obviously, you know, in Ireland, as everyone knows. And you know, and Gladstone goes from being, you know, this absolutely arch Anglican who believed that the state should only provide support for the Anglican Church, for the Church of England, to realising the importance of recognising, in a sense, the Catholicism of the majority of the, you know, the Irish people, and then and the need for them to have homegrown priests, and of course partly that was because priests trained elsewhere in Paris and so on were often bringing, you know, radical ideas back to Ireland, ideas that were not were certainly at odds perhaps with maintaining the Union, and part of then the commitment to Maynooth was hopefully to also generate a slightly more conservative, and I suppose we might say small U unionist priesthood. So what runs through, if you like, that liberalisation of his attitude is him thinking, what do we need to do to secure the Union? What do we need to do to integrate Britain and Ireland? And, you know, as we all know, it's the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Ireland. You know, the Union has this sort of add-on from the beginning of the 19th century, and Gladstone sees all sorts of obstacles to properly, you know, completing the Union. So he's excellent at appealing to certain kinds of Irish nationalist sentiment, and I'm sure we'll come on to that. But, you know, the bottom line is he's a Unionist.
At the bottom line, he's a Unionist. You mentioned his terms as Chancellor of the Exchequer and, you know, quite an extended period, I think 12 years in total. But what's interesting is that he sometimes did both jobs together, Chancellor and Prime Minister.
Yeah, I mean, yes, and this, I mean, this reflects, you know, something of the political expectations of the 19th century, where, you know, the roles were not defined quite as they are today. So that is in some ways not that, you know, surprising. Just as ministers might well sit, you know, in the House of Lords rather than in the House of Commons. Of course, we now, Britain, have a foreign secretary sitting in the House of Lords in Lord Cameron. So these things sort of still go on. But yeah, that sense that, you know, politics as a certainly when Gladstone sort of enters Parliament, you know, politics is a kind of gentleman's, you know, business, and that largely that begins to change over the course, you know, of the 19th century. And if you like, what we now expect in a sense of politics and the different kinds of roles and how they're distributed was only, you know, starting to sort of develop in this period. So yeah, you're absolutely right that you could be, you know, Prime Minister and First Lord of the Treasury, and that's quite a sort of common, you know, combination. And of course, as we know, you know, who holds the purse strings is vitally important to, you know, any politics and what governments do. I mean, just a brief word on those, you know, budgets. Of course, this is also where we see Gladstone as a liberal, bit by bit, lifting various, so these great kind of budgets, lifting various kinds of protectionism, that sort of gradual march from the 1840s onwards towards the kind of free trade that we associate with sort of liberal and imperial economics in the middle to the late 19th century, that then in the early 20th century, because of economic change and global competition and all of those sorts of pressures, starts to tighten up and you get a kind of new politics of protection coming in the early 20th century. But Gladstone is absolutely one of the sort of architects of free trade or laissez-faire liberal economics, and, you know, placed great importance on what he saw as creating kind of a liberal sort of liberal economic structures that would allow, you know, entrepreneurialism and so on, you know, to thrive. And that partly reflects the kind of growing liberal political constituency, which is one that is, you know, is quite strongly urban and, you know, increasingly rooted in the big sort of industrial cities. And, you know, this is a somewhat simplistic, but we can think about liberal and conservative politics in the 19th century as liberal politics, increasingly the politics of the borough, of the urban, and conservative of the county, of the country, and of course rural agricultural interests. But that, as I say, that's putting it into slightly neat boxes, but they're quite helpful boxes for starting to think about Gladstone and what it is to be a liberal in the 19th century.
Tonight's show on Gladstone was inspired by a conference that we both spoke at Hertford College in Oxford in December to mark the 125th anniversary of the death of Gladstone, organised by Professor Ian McBride there, the Foster Chair of Irish History, supported by the Department of Foreign Affairs here, and Martin Fraser, the ambassador to London, opened the conference. And we're also going to be hearing later from two of the contributors, Dr. Caoimhe McDovid of the University of Sheffield and Dr. Andrea Russell, the warden and director of the Gladstone Library. But we also heard at that from Charlie Gladstone, a descendant, and he talked about that slavery question you mentioned. And recently the Gladstone family gave reparations based on what the family had been involved with in the past. But I think Charlie seemed to suggest that it was more the family and the father rather than William himself.
I think that's true. And I think that's sort of broadly fair. I mean, there's no question that Gladstone is the beneficiary of slavery, of the vast, you know, profits. His father was a major slave owner. And so he's undoubtedly a beneficiary sort of that. And early on, he's not associated with abolitionism. And this is William, and is looking for a kind of gradualist, if you like, way out of slavery. But I think later on, I mean, he becomes, you know, firmly of the view that, you know, slavery is abhorrent and so on. So I don't think his slate is perhaps quite as clean as some people sometimes like to think. I think there's a little bit more complexity there, as there is in the sense of all the things we might want to talk about. That there's the very young, you know, there is the young, if you like, zealot in Gladstone, and in some respects he's always zealous. He's just zealous in different ways. So I think there's that. You know, there is a sort of a transition in his thinking, and it's quite a rapid one. But I don't think there's a totally sort of clean slate there. But you know what Gladstone's descendants are doing is, of course, reflective of, you know, a larger move within British society, where, you know, the descendants and in some respects the long term beneficiaries of slavery are sort of trying to grapple with the legacy and trying to work out what their, you know, obligations are, you know, to the descendants of enslaved people. So, instance, what Charlie Gladstone is engaged in, you see also with, for example, the descendants of the Trevelyans, you know, another major, you know, liberal family whose, you know, connections to slavery are now, you know, being looked at, and the family is now grappling with and trying to think somehow or another how can they sort of take account of this. And it's clearly difficult, but I think sincere.
Let's just look very quickly at foreign policy, just to see if there's a kind of an hypocrisy there or an inconsistency. Because when you look at something like his Gladstone's second term as Prime Minister, he does get involved in a war with Egypt, and Britain ends up taking a control effectively of Egypt. And it seems very much at odds with the liberal policies and idealistic policies that Gladstone had been talking about when he was in opposition.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, like all politicians, I think being in opposition allows you a certain amount, you know, of latitude. And then in power, he faces, you know, what we might sort of think of as the sort of realities, you know, of power. And there they are, of course, British interests and, you know, particularly, you know, economic interests in much of the world. And you know, there's a big old story been told by historians about the, you know, the transition from informal to formal empire. And part of this is, you know, occurring over the course, you know, of the 19th century, where challenges to British kind of social and economic and forms we might very loosely refer to as, you know, soft power, but was often underpinned by forms of, you know, violence and so on, increasingly come under threat. And then this leads to the formalization, if you like, you know, of empire, of, if you like, forms of direct rule. There's a term that has resonance in Ireland, but, you know, forms of direct rule, you know, from London. And so I think in office, Gladstone is confronted, you know, with those sorts of realities. You know, there is on the liberal side a skepticism for what somebody talked about at the time as kind of, you know, foreign policy adventurism, and the sense that conservatives and Tories, you know, particularly are prone to get kind of drawn into, if you like, the excitement of empire and the excitement of a kind of an aggressive thrusting, you know, foreign policy. Which, of course, also involved the state spending, you know, lots of money. And that, one of those components of liberal economics, of course, is that, you know, to try to sort of minimise state spending in order to, you know, unleash the powers of the market. Not quite language Gladstone would have used, but language that's circulating. And so then in office, what he's confronted with, you know, is a series of sort of challenges to British power, a series of kind of, you know, military crises, I suppose. And he responds, you know, accordingly, finding himself in a sense, you know, obliged to defend, you know, British interests. So I think he gets a sort of a shock of realpolitik in office. And I think this is something that runs through the whole of Gladstone's career and how he kind of articulated his, you know, commitments, that he had a strong tendency, I think, to sometimes at the time, sometimes retrospectively, to provide very sort of coherent moral justifications or ethical justifications for actions that he took, if you like, under the pressure of day-to-day politics, and to find in retrospect the kind of coherence and consistency there. And he had a particular ability to, you know, shape the narrative to, in a sense, show that he'd been right all along.
He became Prime Minister for the first time in 1868, so at the age of 59, after already having been involved in politics for, well, you know, three decades or more. And the campaign there, he was talking about justice for Ireland. And I wonder, when you look at the, especially the first two administrations, to what extent was he successful? Because there were significant land acts. The second one brought in, you know, fair rent, fixity of tenure and freedom of sale and so on. But there was also various pieces of coercion legislation passed. And, you know, there was a maybe some reform, but also some hardline policies.
Yeah, I mean, I think Gladstone is especially interesting on this. And, you know, the event that you were talking about in Oxford, marking the 125th anniversary of his death. I mean, the paper I gave at that conference or that workshop looked at a famous speech he gives to Parliament in March 1868, which isn't that long before, you know, he becomes, you know, Prime Minister of that, you know, great reforming ministry of 1868 to 74. And that speech ends with this very famous phrase, justice delayed is justice denied. And that's the first time it's used in Parliament. And, you know, and Gladstone ends his speech about Ireland, and it's a speech that's almost entirely focused on Ireland, by saying, you know, justice delayed is justice, you know, denied. And, you know, what he looks at over the course, through that speech, are the issues of the necessity in Ireland for land reform, the necessity for reforms of education, you know, to allow more support for Catholic education. At the time, people talked about it's the denominational education question. And, of course, the disestablishment of the Church of Ireland, which, if we're wanting to find a strong pattern in his career, you know, we can see how Maynooth in the 1840s, Maynooth Grant in the 1840s, then gets us to disestablishment in 1869. And in the speech, Gladstone addresses those three issues: land reform, denominational education, disestablishment of the Church of Ireland. And he argues that England has an open account with Ireland going back, you know, 700 years. So it's remarkable the degree to which, in a sense, he adopts the kind of framing or the language of sort of Irish nationalism, and the political or the moral requirement on Britain, and particularly the English, you know, to deliver and justice for Ireland under those, you know, three headings. And as I said earlier, again, it's about securing the union. And Glasson had a really interesting, you know, attitude towards coercion, towards the suspension of civil liberties, suspension of habeas corpus. And this is where I think he's quite interesting, is to read him as a sort of a populist politician in some respects. And he argued that if the state had got to the point where it had to suspend civil liberties, that was evidence of government failure, that something clearly had gone wrong, and that it was necessary for the government to address the grievances that led to the, if you like, criminal, though perhaps political, activities that seem to necessitate coercion. So what we find again and again, and historians have talked about it in these terms, is this not necessarily always a swing, but very often a simultaneous approach by the British state, you know, under the headings of coercion and conciliation. The fact that they had to resort to coercion suggests it's been a failure of government. And it's not just it's been a failure of government in terms of the, if you like, managing or suppressing or controlling the people. It's that the causes of that resistant activism, what you have it, has underlying causes. And those underlying causes reflects, you know, failures in government. So really throughout the period, I mean, throughout, in a way, the history of the union, you know, or certainly up to, you know, partition, there's this sort of constant swinging between, conciliation and coercion as successive British governments, and most particularly Gladstone's, but not exclusively, Tory governments do it too, trying to come up with legislative responses to Irish discontent that will ultimately stabilise the union. So just to give you an idea of this, he talks, for instance, about Fenianism. In a most remarkable passage in the speech, he talks about Fenianism as reasoned and deliberate. Now, Gladstone's response to Fenianism, of course, isn't an Irish Republic separate from the UK, which is what, in theory at least, the Fenians wanted. Again, the issue is how do we conciliate? His, as I say, what you have then with that first ministry, as you said, was, you know, we've got to look at land, we've got to look at denominational education, we've got to look at disestablishment. In a sense, the only one of those that really works is disestablishment. And the disestablishment of the Church of Ireland is an enormous shock to the Anglo-Irish, you know, if you like, the Anglo-Irish ascendancy. And as Gladstone says in the speech, it makes them like everyone else. If almost everyone in Ireland in the 19th century has a religious identity, then by disestablishing the church, what you then have in this, it makes the Anglicans also another voluntary church in Ireland that has to somehow sustain itself with little, you know, direct and support from, you know, the state and tithe and so on. But in each case, land reform, denominational education, there's only so much you can push through at this point.
Well, tonight we are talking about Gladstone. We're going to take a quick break now. When we come back, I'll be talking to Dr. Andrea Russell, the first woman to be the warden of the Gladstone Library in Wales. So stay with us here on News Talk. Welcome back to Talking History as we explore the life and legacy of Gladstone. And I'm delighted to be joined by Dr. Andrea Russell, the warden and director of the Gladstone Library in Wales. Andrea, you're very welcome.
Hello, nice to speak to you.
Well, Andrea, first of all, tell us about the Gladstone Library and tell us about your role as warden.
Yeah, thank you. So I am it depends how you count, whether I'm the 13th or the 14th warden of Gladstone Library. There was a caretaker, son-in-law of Gladstone, who began it, but then the first proper warden, if you like, was Reverend Joyce. So if we count from him, I'm the 13th warden, and I am the first woman. And so the warden of Gladstone's Library is always an Anglican priest, and so trying to work out what my role is here has been half the fun. So I've been here just over a year. So I think that sort of formally, my role is to have oversight of the sort of business, intellectual and spiritual life of the library. And sort of informally, it's a bit like a sort of cross between Fawlty Towers and Vicar of Dibley. But you get that sort of idea.
And tell us about the library, because it's massive. It has 26 bedrooms. It has its own restaurant. It has the enormous library that has such huge, the huge collection that Gladstone himself collected. There's reading rooms and alcoves where you can do your research. Like, it's an incredible resource and treasure.
It's absolutely beautiful. It looks bigger on the outside than it is really on the inside, which is interesting. But yes, we do. We have 26 bedrooms. We're the only, we say we're the only residential library, because here you don't have to prove why you want to come and stay and use our reading rooms. The reading rooms themselves are stunningly beautiful, and they reflect how Gladstone wanted his library to look. So he didn't actually ever see this building. It was created after his death as in memoriam to him. But it used his plans for the way that the shelving is. It's crenellated shelving. And we have over 20,000 books of his, where he began the collection with those. We also hold unique archives to do with the Gladstone Glynn family. So, yeah, we are a unique place, and it is very beautiful.
Because in the United States, it's quite normal that as soon as a president leaves office, they establish their presidential library. But there isn't something similar in the United Kingdom. But Gladstone is the only former prime minister to have his own prime ministerial library.
Yeah, absolutely. And interestingly, when he began this, he didn't really want it to be all about him, which probably is a bit of a reflection of the man in some ways. This was about him sharing what was important to him. And so we know that reading, you know, his the scope of his reading was incredible. So his diaries show us that, you know, if you added up, it counts as one book a day, literally, for the whole of his life. So the man is reading a tremendous amount. And as his life is starting to come to an end, he's thinking about what he wants to leave behind him. And what he wants to do is share something that's been really important to him. And so he begins the library with 20,000 of his own books. And his dream is that this would be a place that would encourage divine learning. So at the beginning, it's mainly for clergy. But what is really interesting is that the books that he deposits here are not all about theology and the Bible. They go through theology and spirituality, but also politics and history and classical literature. So his whole idea of learning, even for clergy, was about them engaging widely with the world. And that's the vision that we're trying to continue.
What's the standing of Gladstone in the United Kingdom today? Because I know the family have recently given reparations for their involvement. I think it was Gladstone's father, his involvement in the slave trade. How is Gladstone? Because I think that perhaps his reputation as a kind of a moralistic religious figure, that kind of in some ways is held against him, that he's not seen as fun or interesting or relatable.
I think you're right. I mean, I've been interested because we had the former president of Armenia come to visit this year for Founders Day. And Gladstone is still very much taught in schools in Armenia and very much seen as, you know, the saviour of Armenia in lots of ways. I mean, I can remember doing Gladstone at school for A-level and, you know, thinking he was very boring and Disraeli was very exciting. And I think that has been that sort of view of him. You know, the Queen Victoria's, you know, he speaks to me as if he's addressing a public meeting. That sort of idea. And this idea that his religion was quite moralistic and so forth. But I found in this, I mean, I've only been here just over a year. And as I've dug deeper, I think there's a real sense of ethical standing with the man, which, you know, we don't find that easy these days to think about. And I think he's also a man who was prepared to change his mind, which, again, I think is quite an interesting conversation to be having in the political arena at the moment.
He was Prime Minister four times and also had a lengthy period as Chancellor of the Exchequer. And there was an overlap as well where he had the two jobs. What contribution do you think he made to British history? Because it seems to have been an incredible contribution as much as his time as Chancellor as it was for his time as Prime Minister.
Yeah, and what is interesting is we have a special collection here that's been donated by one of our readers called Faith in Capitalism. And we're having a course later in the year that actually looks at that. And it's meant to catch both things, the idea of, you know, what is the role of faith in this area of economics? And you know, should we have faith in capitalism? And the way that what we're hoping to come out of that course as well is looking at some of those issues that I think he was grappling with. And how do you do that well? And I mean, he's not a man beyond reproach, but the way that he takes stands on some of these, I think is interesting. I don't know enough on this to be able to give a really, you know, in-depth answer. But the way that he approaches being Chancellor, I think is possibly key to the way that he is Prime Minister. I mean, I don't know what you think, because obviously you've got an interest in him as well.
I have an interest in him, absolutely. And we were all at this wonderful event in Hertford College in Oxford just before Christmas to mark the 125th anniversary of his death. And what I found fascinating was that it was an event in part organised with the Department of Foreign Affairs in Ireland and the Irish Embassy in London. And it was the Irish side commemorating him, because I think in some ways his stock is maybe higher in this country because of his involvement in the Home Rule movement in the 1880s. And he's up there with Tony Blair in the pantheon of British prime ministers who did something positive for Ireland.
And I think that's really interesting, because I think you just mentioned about Charlie Gladstone and the slavery issues. And I think particularly in the last 5 years, because of Gladstone's father, John, his holdings in Guyana, you know, the unquestionable suffering that was brought through that, the high compensation and so forth that he received, that has rubbed off, I think, on William Gladstone, and undeservedly so in some areas, I think. I mean, it's not that isn't a question for us to discuss, and, you know, we have scholarships looking into this. We have records within our archives to do with John Gladstone and his business holdings, and we want to be a place where those sort of quite difficult and nuanced conversations can take place. But I think you're right, and I think, you know, the idea that he was championing democracy for sections of the public is often missed, that he was seen as a working class champion. I think that needs to come back and be remembered with him as well. And you're right, you know, it's interesting that other countries seem to have him in higher standing than possibly we do here. I mean, I don't know why you think that is.
I wonder, is it that he seems too remote and difficult to understand, that we can kind of understand a figure like Disraeli because he's a man on the make, and he's probably no different to a lot of politicians in Britain and around the world today, but there aren't many figures like Gladstone around today.
Yeah. I mean, that's interesting. And maybe that idea even then, although you say that, but, you know, as I'm starting to do some work on him, he attracted thousands to his talks, his speeches. So I think there was one of his last ones was in Chester, and, you know, it was standing room. And we know that people came to visit him in Harden, so lots of labourers came to see him. I wonder whether he was more charismatic than we gather. I mean, I don't know what you think about that. I mean, his speeches are rousing, aren't they?
Absolutely. And he did seem to be able to energise that perhaps what worked in the 1880s and the early 1890s, perhaps, and indeed earlier in the 60s and 70s and so on, perhaps it seems alien to us now, but was very effective then.
Yeah. So I think he's one of those people that yes, I think he probably was quite stern. I think he was very focused. I think he knew what he wanted. I think he can seem unbending, and yet we know that he does bend during his lifetime. So maybe it's the press that he's given, which is more difficult to get. But so I have to keep, you know, I have a picture of him on the wall, and you think you must be much more charismatic than I think you are, and much more passionate about some of this. So maybe that's, you know, one of the things that we're trying to do is how do we unlock his legacy in some way that becomes meaningful for particularly perhaps for younger people, for the sort of 16 to 24 age group.
And finally, Andrea, who would you like to visit the Gladstone Library? Because all our listeners, do you want scholars who want to use the collections? Or if there was someone who was just interested in Gladstone and his contribution to Irish history, should they feel like they should email and that they'd be welcome to visit as well?
I mean, I want to say everyone. I mean, yes, from, you know, people who already have a passion and an interest in this and are, you know, published, down to those who are just beginning an interest, and actually those for whom finding a place where learning is celebrated, where silence is protected, where conversation happens over dinner, in the Gladstone room, you know, over a glass of wine, where actually we want to just celebrate learning. And if you, you know, we want questioning minds here and people who want to have conversation, not just debate. So if you, you know, if any of the listeners hear themselves in that description, you are more than welcome here. And if you do, then let me know and we'll have a cup of coffee.
Well, it sounds absolutely wonderful. Thank you so much, Andrea, for joining us tonight. Dr. Andrea Russell, the Warden and Director of Gladstone's Library. You'll be able to just Google the Gladstone Library and you'll find out all the contact details there, and you'll be able to get your directions and plan your visit if you do want to visit. And Andrea, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And now to continue our discussion on the legacy and reputation of Gladstone, especially in an Irish context, I'm delighted to be joined by Dr. Caoimhe Nic Dóibhéid, who's a senior lecturer in modern history at the University of Sheffield and an expert on the Irish Revolution. And her books include Terrorist Histories, Individuals and Political Violence Since the 19th Century. Caoimhe, you're very welcome.
Hi, Patrick. Nice to be here.
We were on a panel together at Hertford College just before Christmas on to mark the 125th anniversary of the death of Gladstone. And you had a fascinating paper on how Gladstone's name was invoked in Ireland and in Irish political debates and in the Irish thought in the 20th century. And it's fascinating to see how often his name was mentioned.
Yeah, I mean, I thought it would be interesting just to kind of trace how does Gladstone feature in the debates during the Irish Revolution as various legislative pieces of legislation are put forward, both in Westminster and in the Irish Dáil. And it's not surprising that, as we might expect, he looms much larger in Westminster debates than he does in Dáil Éireann. There's kind of three key ways, I think, in which MPs in Westminster and members of the House of Lords from numerous parties are using the name of Gladstone to kind of add legitimacy or to burnish their arguments. And so it's part of a deliberate rhetorical strategy that these politicians are invoking the name of Gladstone, and that goes right across the political spectrum: liberal, conservative, unionist and nationalist. So there's a number of ways that Gladstone appears in Westminster. First, he's invoked as a fearless liberal defender of humanitarian values against despotism and tyranny. And this was particularly the case during the debates around the introduction of harsh, coercive legislation in Ireland at the end of the First World War, and as the debate around reprisals, British reprisals, really gathers pace in 1920 and into 1921. And in this instance, it's primarily nationalist MPs, so those Irish nationalist MPs, those members of the Irish Parliamentary Party who were returned in 1918, these are the ones who are arguing that liberals who are voting for the preservation of some of the DORA legislation or the introduction of special legislation to deal with the IRA campaign are betraying the liberal principles of Gladstone. So Joseph Devlin, MP for Belfast West, declared that it was enough to make Gladstone turn in his grave to see liberals voting away the liberties of the nation to which Gladstone's life was consecrated. So that's one of the types of arguments that is made. And of course, Gladstone had been particularly famous in Westminster for defending the rights of Armenians against Turkish atrocities and Turkish despotism. And there's kind of arguments made that, you know, British black and tan reprisals in Ireland are just as bad as, or even worse than what happened under the Turkish yoke in Armenia. So that's a common thread. Secondly, Gladstone appears as a sort of a benevolent godfather or a safeguarder of the Irish nation. And so particularly when the Government of Ireland Bill is introduced, which can be understood as a sort of a fourth Home Rule Bill, it is presented or argued for as sort of a culmination of Gladstone's grand project in Ireland. So he's invoked as this kind of benevolent overseer of the Irish nation, and in fact in some instances it's used as, you know, the government of Ireland, which of course divides Ireland into two components, Northern Ireland and Southern Ireland. The fact that none of Gladstone's Home Rule bills had envisaged the partition of Ireland, this is used as a kind of as an argument against partition. So you have some Liberal MPs and some Nationalist MPs who are invoking Gladstone to undermine the partition mechanism within the Government of Ireland Act. And then finally, by the time the treaty is debated in Westminster, the Anglo-Irish Treaty in December 1921, Gladstone, it's sort of used as his name is used as a way of indicating the magnitude of the task before Parliament. The opportunities of the agreement signed in Downing Street. You know, Gladstone is this political behemoth whose mighty will and intellect had been defeated by the intractability of the Irish question. Wouldn't it be wonderful if now, at long last, we could lay the ghost of Gladstone to rest and bring to fruition this great kind of unfinished project that he had. So that's how Gladstone appears in Westminster.
And it's very different in the Oireachtas, in the Dáil, because the very first mention of Gladstone is by Michael Collins, the Minister for Finance. And Collins, it turned out, was not a fan.
No, I mean, Gladstone didn't have very many fans in the Revolutionary Dáil, or indeed in much of the Dáil after that, in post-revolutionary Ireland. Collins mentions him as Minister for Finance to note that as Chancellor of the Exchequer, Gladstone inflicted more taxation upon Ireland than any other British Chancellor except for Asquith. So it's quite interesting. Gladstone appears in the revolutionary debates and in post-revolutionary Dáil debates much less frequently than you might expect. And it's more in terms of the outworkings of finance legislation and taxation legislation, not so much in relation to land tenure, which he instituted, you know, in the 19th century. Cathal Brua also mentioned Gladstone once, Minister for Defence, in a typically feisty speech in September 1920, where he declared that Ireland had no friends in England. Asquith was a worse enemy of Ireland than Lloyd George. Gladstone was a greater enemy than Castlereagh. English Labour was just as hostile as English capital. So he doesn't feature much in revolutionary debates and in relation to home rule as such, because I suppose political debate has moved on in Ireland. The Dáil MPs, the Dáil TDs, are not interested in home rule. They want a republic.
He becomes kind of a punchline or part of a kind of a humorous riposte in later decades there, where if someone mentions something that happened in the past a decade or two decades ago, they'd respond with, well, what did Gladstone say?
Yeah, sort of a running joke, particularly among Fianna Fáil deputies. So it's kind of thrown out as a way of batting off opposition criticism for the measures that Fianna Fáil took in government after 1922. So you'd have Cumann Gael and later Fine Gael or Labour TDs attempting to embarrass the Fianna Fáil government by pointing out what Lamass or McEntee or De Valera said in 1922 or 1928, and to try and kind of shut down that line of attack, Fianna Fáil deputies will throw out, what did Gladstone say in 1886? And so that occurs quite frequently in the Dáil record. And it's an echo of, I think, the way Gladstone appears in Westminster debates, throughout the early 20th and indeed into the mid-century, because he's used as a kind of with a veneer of authority. I remember what Gladstone said in 1885. I remember what Gladstone said in 1872. That is used to kind of legitimise political argument, but it's inverted in the Dáil and in quite a kind of a funny way, actually.
And it's interesting when you look at more recent references to Gladstone in the Oireachtas. It's usually in connection with the peace process, and Tony Blair is mentioned. So it's Gladstone and Blair, the two British prime ministers who did more for Ireland than anyone else.
He definitely had a late moment in the political spotlight, I suppose, as the peace process reached fruition in the 1990s. And particular, people who were familiar with Gladstone's work, like like Martin Manzra or John Bruton, people who understood, I suppose, the long sweep of Irish history and saw a continuity or a sort of full circle in terms of the initiatives for addressing the Irish question or the British question in Ireland, if you might put it that way, that Gladstone initiated in the 19th century, and, you know, history coming full circle at the end of the 20th century.
And it's interesting the way Gladstone's reputation does seem to be higher in Ireland now than it is in Britain because of his support for Home Rule in the 1880s. And yet in Britain, though, it's more, well, I suppose there's the shadow of this, the family connection with slavery. And then I think he's just seen as this kind of arch moralist to religious figure. And it doesn't really chime well with what people want to see in their historical icons.
Yeah, of course, you know, at the seminar that we spoke at last month, there was a really entertaining and illuminating lecture delivered by Dr. Robert Saunders of Queen Mary University, where he juxtaposed Benjamin Disraeli with William Gladstone, these two kind of polar opposite figures who dominated mid-Victorian and late Victorian politics in Britain. And they are two extremely different characters who made very different appeals to the British public, and both had great political success. Yeah, I think you're right, though, that the kind of the slavery connection has definitely overshadowed Gladstone's contribution, I suppose, to political good government in the United Kingdom. That has yet to really, I think, dislodge how Gladstone is understood in Irish historiography, where the significance of his contribution, particularly to land reform, still is widely noted.
Well, my thanks to Dr. Caoimhe Nicdóibhead of the Department of History at the University of Sheffield for joining us tonight to discuss the life and legacy of Gladstone. We're going to take a quick break now. When we come back, we'll be continuing our discussion and exploring the impact of Gladstone on Irish and British politics. So stay with us here on News Talk. Welcome back to our special Gladstone show. I'm delighted to be rejoined by Professor Matthew Kelly, Professor of Modern History in the Department of Humanities at Northumbria University, an expert on modern British history. He's also, of course, an expert on modern Irish history and wrote the wonderful essay on radical nationalisms for the Cambridge History of Ireland. And I have to say, Matthew, it's a piece that I give my own students on Blackboard as well. And it really very, very much sets the agenda for our debates about 1882 to 1916. And there's a lot going on there. And I wonder, when we try and assess the legacy of Gladstone, and especially when we try to assess it with Ireland, you know, does he deserve that acclaim that he seems to have in Ireland now in the 21st century, where he's always linked with Blair as the two British prime ministers who tried to do the most for Ireland?
To some extent, yes. I mean, I think we could certainly never deny that he's enormously important to Irish politics in the late 19th century, at that absolutely crucial period where, you know, home rule emerges as unquestionably the dominant political, you know, commitment of, you know, Irish nationalists in the period. Certainly if you're measuring commitments through how people vote. You know, there's this really important thing happens with the extension of the franchise in Ireland, is that you get the replacement of liberal and conservative politics with home rule and unionist politics, and it divides, you know, largely on denominational or sort of sectarian lines. And I think Gladstone fully recognises, not uniquely, of course, but he's uniquely placed to fully recognise in political terms the significance of that change. And I think he's also right in terms of, you know, what he identifies as the issues, if you like, or the problems: land, education, status of the church, are the key issues in many ways. And then, of course, you know, and he sees in home rule the solution. I mean, you know, he is a formidable political figure. Now, is there political calculation at work? Yes, undoubtedly. Is he often acting in terms of the self-interest of his own party? Yes, he is. But what he does, and I think he does have this in common actually with Blair, and it's a criticism that's often levelled at political leaders today, particularly in the current British government, is the failure, in a sense, to lead the people, the failure to convince, if you like, the people of the necessity of a particular, you know, set of policies or a particular, you know, agenda. So whether we like Gladstone or whether we like, you know, Blair, I think what they have in common, and I hate to use this word, but they have an ability to articulate a certain kind of visionary politics or a certain vision of politics, which is seeking to, you know, convince people of an argument, convince people of a position. So I think he's an endlessly sort of fascinating figure in that regard. It is worth mentioning that there were people who found, you know, and not just conservatives, who found Gladstone a very off-putting figure, you know, and a slightly ridiculous figure in some ways. The kind of, you know, the moralising tone, the hectoring, the lecturing tone of him. And indeed, there were very, very senior people within the Liberal Party. I mean, we'd talk about them as representing the kind of Whig tradition, that found Gladstone's popularism, his desire to rouse the people, sometimes indeed against the more conservative elements within the Liberal Party, is dangerous. That Gladstone was a potentially dangerous figure who risked giving the people too strong a sense of their power over, you know, the political process. So there's also you know that side of him, that side of him as in a way a sort of a populist, you know, leader who places himself as the kind of, you know, tribune of the people. But with respect to, you know, Ireland, I think he does to a great extent deserve his reputation. Yeah.
It's funny, I think he has a better reputation in Ireland than he does have in Britain, because the image of him, I think, in Britain is of this, you know, old, moralising, you know, out of touch kind of figure. And I think the full extent of the career isn't really properly examined or understood.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's probably remarkable, actually, the degree also to which Gladstone, I think, insofar as, you know, there is a popular view of the man, it's probably now is strongly associated, you know, with Ireland and those later years, you know, the 1880s the 1890s. So I think, you know, insofar as people think about the 19th century, you know, at all, and this is peculiar thing, you know, we're both just about old enough, you know, to see that with the turn of the 21st century, the 19th century suddenly became this rather distant era, where it went from being the last century to being two centuries ago, you know, and it's had this strangely sort of distancing effect. And I think in the last couple of years, we've perhaps started to see a revival of interest in the 19th century, but for a long time, it was, you know, quite neglected. So it would be interesting to see if that sort of revival of interest leads then to a kind of reassessment of Gladstone.
Well, my thanks to the brilliant Professor Matthew Kelly of Northumbria University. We were also joined earlier by the wonderful Dr. Caoimhe Nic Dóibhéad of the Department of History at the University of Sheffield, and also heard from Dr. Andrea Russell, the Warden and Director of the Gladstone Library in Wales. That does bring us to the end of another edition of Talking History. My thanks to Marisa Sullivan, my producer, and to Peter Malloy on sound. We've got more debate and discussion next week, so hope you can join us then. We've been Talking History. Good night.